It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This weekend, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra explores strange new worlds with the PNC Pops Sci-Fi Spectacular. The concert features music from classic sci-fi TV programs and films such as 2001, A Space Odyssey, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and Star Trek, among others. The host of the show is actor and activist George Takei, one of the stars of the first Star Trek TV series, who originated the role of Sulu, helmsman of the Starship Enterprise. Beyond Star Trek, there are many aspects of this man's life and career to explore, including his role in the award-winning musical Allegiance, which is coming to Broadway, and he joins us now in Studio A. George Takei, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Great to have you.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Let's begin by having you tell us about what you will be doing with the Pittsburgh Symphony this weekend.
It's called A Sci-Fi Spectacular. Jack Everly is the conductor, and we've been doing it all over the country, working with various symphony orchestras. It's the music from sci-fi movies and television series, and we talk about science fiction, and particularly about Star Trek, and how Star Trek used science fiction as a metaphor for issues of our times. And in the second act, I do the soliloquy that Klaatu has from The Day the Earth Stood Still to the music of Bernard Herrmann, and that's my favorite point in the concert. It's a powerful and sobering message to humankind on its warlike tendencies. And if we don't get our act together, there will be a price to be paid. So those who know that film, the original, The Day the Earth Stood Still, they remade it recently with Keanu Reeves. And as with
You're
so
talking about the Michael Rennie.
Right. That's the original, yeah, yes, the Michael Rennie one. And he has that great speech.
Patricia Neal. Yeah.
Patricia Neal, yes.
That's the one. That's really the – what's amazing about that film is that – and I want to talk about how much Star Trek was ahead of its time, which you've just indicated. But this was the 50s when The Day the Earth Stood Still came out. And as you just – pointed out, this was a movie that was, a century or 60 years ago, I should say, over half a century ago, talking about how we, as you put it, better get our act together.
Well, I think this is my personal feeling. The human animal was blessed with two gifts. One was our intelligence and our inventive and curiosity to gather information and put it together and innovate. The other gift that we had was our killer instinct. At that time, it was an asset. We were able to get our food, protect our kind, and create a village. But our brains also kept giving us the ability to enhance our killer instinct. If you put a point on a stick, you can kill someone from something, some animal, without getting too close to it. Or you can even throw that stick and get your food or protect your kind. But that inventive mind gave us the ability to kill many people from long distances. And now we have devices that will kill automatically. And so it's become a liability now. And with Star Trek, we did deal with that notion. But it's that kind of conflict that science fiction allows us to examine.
You can join our conversation with actor and activist George Takei by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. If there's something that you've always wanted to ask George Takei, now is your chance. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. With regard to the concerts this weekend with the Pittsburgh Symphony, there is something about sci-fi that just seems to go so well with a symphonic score, isn't there?
Exactly. And science fiction movies have been enriched and enhanced by great music. John Williams, what he contributed to Star Wars, E.T., The Day That no, – that's Bernard Herrmann, but Close Encounters of the
– Of the Third Kind.
Third Kind, yes. And certainly Star Trek. So it's an evening of that music. And we also make it a lot of fun, not just nostalgia for those movies. And Jack Everly, our conductor, has a trivia quiz. And someone in the audience every night and matinee can go home with a lightsaber.
Ooh. Wow. Be careful with those on your way home, I guess. But, you know, it's interesting that the composers of this, and you mentioned Bernard Herrmann and The Day the Earth Stood Still. He's the guy that did Psycho and mm-hmm. so many other film scores that I think Psycho really drives the point home. It's more horror than sci-fi, obviously, but it drives the point home. I mean, imagine Psycho without that whole score. It's
yes,
not the same movie.
That stabbing sequence without Bernard Herrmann's music. Or I think he also composed for Citizen Kane. So, you know, he tells the story with music and enhances and sometimes strengthens the dramatic point with his compositions. And that's what we get in our concert with the Sci-Fi Spectacular.
Well, if you're interested in attending any of the performances, again, it opens tomorrow night. And then there's Saturday and Sunday performances. By all means, call the symphony. And I believe there are some tickets available. So
there are tickets available.
We don't want to just tease them and then have them not be able to go. You can experience this. And
I might point out, we begin at 7:30, not 8 o'clock. The time sometimes, you know, traditionally most concerts begin at 8 o'clock. But we begin at 7:30 at night. At Friday night and Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30.
So you get home. You know, you get home a little earlier. You're not
exactly.
It's not a terribly late night. You are. It's great to have you in Pittsburgh, George. And you are no stranger to Pittsburgh. You had an interesting role in the Nickelodeon series Super Ninjas, which filmed here in town until it was canceled. I think it was about a year ago. What was it like for you? The experience of living here in Pittsburgh and working here for a while.
Well, I first discovered Pittsburgh back in the 70s, and I must say I came with a stereotyped notion of Pittsburgh, a black soot-covered city. But when the cab took me into that tunnel and we reached a light at the end of the tunnel, and bam, the glory of Pittsburgh hits you. The soaring skyscraper, the fascinating architecture, and the Allegheny and the Monongahela. We cross the Monongahela, but you see the rivers coming together to form the Ohio. And then while we were filming Super Ninjas, we got to explore the city and get to know it. Market Square and wonderful restaurants. I love New Orleans food, Cajun food, and there it is in all its spiciness. Or on the Strip, there's a relatively new restaurant, Italian restaurant, called Cioppino. And I love Cioppino, but their other Italian dishes are wonderful as well. And then I can't remember the name of the district, farther to the east, a Japanese restaurant called Umi, U-M-I, which means ocean. Superb Japanese restaurant, comparable to Nobu in L.A. or New York, you know. So the dining delights. And being a theater person, I discovered the theater here. Public theater, first-class theater, comparable to New York. And so this is a wonderful city and a city with unique character as well. And that's why so many films are shot here. Batman had its opening while we were filming at the Heinz Theater, I think. And that's where we'll be with the sci-fi concerts.
And that's, again, this weekend at Heinz Hall, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra and the Sci-Fi Spectacular. Let's talk about Star Trek. It's certainly the thing that you are most identified with. The original series came to TV in 1966. You were a young actor. If I did my math correctly, you were still in your 20s.
Yes.
when this opportunity came about. How did you end up getting the part of Hikaru Sulu? And most of us don't even realize he had a first name because it's just Sulu or Mr. Sulu.
It was slipped in well into the movie series. They didn't refer to Sulu's first name in the TV series.
Okay, so here you are. You're Mr. Sulu, helmsman of the Starship Enterprise. How did it happen?
In a very ordinary Hollywood way, my agent called. I went for the interview, met Gene Roddenberry. What was unusual was when you're going up for a pilot film, a series, there's usually a battery of people there, all the studio executives and the potential advertisers, advertising agencies are there. But in the case of the Star Trek interview, it was just Gene Roddenberry. And it wasn't – we didn't have that desk between us. He came out from behind the desk, ushered me to a corner area with sofas, and we had a nice conversation. And he described the series to me. And I was absolutely thrilled just listening to the description of the series. And for a young actor who'd been, bobbing around in Hollywood doing small guest shots and not very, the most satisfying roles. And here he was describing a starship, a metaphor for the planet Earth and its diversity coming together and working in concert. And the cast was going to reflect that. And he said that it's a show that's going to have an optimistic view of our future. I wanted to do the series. But Hollywood traditionally gives you that period of sitting on pins and needles, suspense. And it took about 10 days before I heard. And I got the call from my agent. I had the role.
How did that change your life?
It was a life-changing experience because my first series, steady work. I mean, just those practical things. But also looking forward to each script because it was a quality show. We had great writers. Gene Roddenberry had written the Bible for the show, and it talked about it. He used science fiction as a metaphor for issues of the times. So we dealt with the civil rights movement, with which I was personally engaged as well. Also the Vietnam War. It was a time of the hippie movement, and that was reflected. And it was a point where the Cold War was at its coldest, and that too was a part of what we talked about. So it was exciting to look forward to the scripts and see what issues we might be dealing with. So it was a show that I'm proud to be associated with. And thanks to the fan support, we got a movie series out of it 10 years after we were canceled.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that because, as you just said, 10 years. So the show has three seasons on NBC.
And each episode began with the anthemic statement, we were boldly going on a five-year mission. And we discovered that the real adversaries weren't the Klingons. It was the NBC programming executives. They aborted our five-year mission in 3 years, but we showed them.
Well, I mean, could you have envisioned in 1969 when the show was taken off the air that in another decade we're going to be this mega movie franchise?
Well... I said when we were filming the pilot, I smell quality with this show. I said that to Jimmy Doohan, who played Scotty. I said, because this is a quality show, that means we're doomed. Because every show that I loved, that I really enjoyed, lasted no more than 2-3 seasons. And I said, we're going to be canceled soon. And sure enough, my prediction came true. But that's the way it is in show business. We have closing nights in the theater. We have cancellations in television. With movies, we have the rep.
But this show rose from the ashes like none ever has.
In two more years, we're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary, the golden anniversary of Star Trek.
What is it about the show that has this kind of hold on people that has lasted for, as you said, nearly half a century? What is it?
I think at the very core, Star Trek looked to the future, and we talked about the 23rd century, with optimism. It was a bright future that we envisioned before us, where most science fiction see a dystopian society, you know, either the humans grubbing around in the ruins of a once great civilization, or being ruled by apes or machines, robots, you know. We said, no, if we have confidence in our problem-solving capabilities, our inventive genius, our entrepreneurial spirit, we can meet every challenge, working as a team and a diverse team, and go on to the next frontier. It was a very optimistic show, and I think that was attractive to people. Whereas, I guess dystopian societies, too, are attractive to people because those stories get told and are very successful as well.
We're talking with George Takei, who played Sulu on Star Trek, and there's so much more to explore about this man's life and career. And we also want to welcome you into the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Let's go to Jake in Lawrenceville. Jake, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with George Takei.
Thank you very much for having me. George, just want to say I'm a big fan, and I'm looking forward to the concert this weekend.
Great. Do join us.
If I may, George, I'd like to have you speak to the audience. I've followed it a little closely, but I think the greater audience could benefit from you talking about your activism, your role as a celebrity, and the Star Trek audience and the greater sort of sci-fi audience world and the general population here in America. Your activism in the Japanese-American community as well as the gay community. I know two very wide subjects, but if you could speak just a little bit, I think listeners would really benefit from how you have shown a light on those two communities.
And your activism goes way, way back. But thank you for bringing that up, Jake.
Well, you said my activism within the Japanese-American community and a separate issue with the LGBT, they're both related. They both deal with equality in our democratic system. When I was a child, Pearl Harbor was bombed, and this nation went into was swept with hysteria because now we're Japanese Americans, American citizens. My mother was born in Sacramento. My father was a San Franciscan. They met in Los Angeles, and I was born there. But we looked like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. And this nation was swept by this hysteria. And they looked at Japanese Americans in the same way that they looked at the people of Japan. We were looked at with suspicion and fear and outright hatred. And President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was swept up in this hysteria and ordered all Japanese Americans on the West Coast, roughly 120,000 of us, to be rounded up with no charges, with no trial, with no due process, and to be imprisoned behind these barbed wire prison camps all spread out through the most desolate parts of this country. We were sent to a camp in the swamps of southeastern Arkansas. And I relate that to the LGBT movement, because the Japanese Americans were incarcerated in very real barbed wire encampments. The LGBT community, up until very recent times, were imprisoned in legalistic barbed wire fences with the sharp, hard barbs of ignorance and bigotry in them. But LGBT people are innocent people. We've committed no crimes, but discrimination put us, LGBT people, behind those legalistic barbed wire fences. You know, when I was a kid, it was illegal to be gay. If you gathered in a gay bar, the police came to raid you, and they booked you, they fingerprinted you, took your photograph, and had your name on a list. Now, if that were exposed, it was disastrous. It was catastrophic for gay people. They could have lost their jobs. They could have lost their families. And their lives became hopeless. Horrible things happened. And those that were serving in the military heroically, patriotically, when they were found to be gay, they were publicly ostracized and fired from their jobs, from the military. People that were defending this country. And certainly none of the civil rights were available to LGBT people. We are the children of straight people. We are literally members of the family and still regarded in that way. Thank God now we live in a much more enlightened society. Two-thirds of the states in the United States grant marriage equality. And yet still today we have a third of the United States that don't. But I'm very confident that within the next few years we will be able to pledge our allegiance to the United States of America. So, you know, the imprisonment of innocent American citizens who happen to be of Japanese ancestry is parallel to this story of what the LGBT community has gone through and still will have to go through in order to be totally full American citizens.
You came out, you made the choice to be openly gay about 10 years ago now. What went into the timing of that decision? Obviously a very personal decision. What led you to make the decision that I'm going to let the world know who I really am when you made it?
Well, I've been closeted most of my life because I wanted a career. I passionately loved acting, and it would have been pointless, stupid to be an out actor. No one would have hired you.
So during the height of Star Trek, if you had been open about your sexuality, what would have happened?
I would have, you know, met some kind of accident. They might have given me a red shirt, put me in security, and I would be gone. It was suicidal to be out and think you can pursue an acting career. But because of the gay liberation movement that was going on, things were starting to happen. Things were starting to change. And in 2004, Massachusetts, Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts granted marriage equality. That was the first state. But in 2005, something equally precedent-setting happened in California. Our California state legislature, both houses, the Senate and the Assembly, passed the Marriage Equality Bill. The first time it came through the legislative route, it went to the desk of the governor, and with his signature, it would have become the law of the state. But Arnold Schwarzenegger, the movie star, was the governor at that time. He ran saying, "I'm a friend of the LGBT community." Yet his base was the conservative Republican side, and that's what he played to. He vetoed it. And I was so livid, my blood was boiling, that I had to speak out on that issue. And I decided, well, I've had a good career. Now maybe, you know, is the time to gracefully fade out. And so I spoke to the press for the first time as a gay man, and I blasted Arnold Schwarzenegger's veto. And I've been in the advocacy arena for LGBT equality ever since then, 2005.
So you were thinking, well, here goes. I may not get another job, sounds like.
But ironically,
but yes.
What happened was my career just blossomed. I was getting guest appearances all over, not as a character. Well, they were characters, but the characters were named George Takei, and those characters were gay. So I had a series of guest shots on television as gay George Takei, and also other things began to happen. And I got an invitation from the Howard Stern Show to be the official announcer. And then I met a tremendously gifted composer lyricist. I've been on speaking tours, speaking out on the interment of Japanese Americans. And we've also founded a museum called the Japanese American National Museum. But these were all reaching people through their brains, their intellect. We needed to reach them also in their hearts with the power of drama and the power of music. And I found this tremendously gifted composer-lyricist, Jay Kuo, and developed a Broadway-bound musical, which we opened first in San Diego at the Old Globe Theater, where we broke all box office and attendance records.
An award-winning show.
Indeed. We won the Best New Musical Award from the San Diego Critics Circle. And we are now Broadway-bound. Next year, 2015, is going to be the Year of Allegiance.
Finally, because people have been waiting for this musical to get to Broadway.
A long wait.
But it's going to happen.
It is going to happen. We have a theater pledged to us. It's not official yet, but we will be getting that theater most likely after the Tony Awards.
I want to talk more about Allegiance, the nature of the show, and your experience as a child being in these Japanese internment camps.
Japanese American. We weren't imprisoned by the Japanese.
Right.
That's what the term Japanese internment camp suggests. We were in U.S. internment camps, and I always point that out.
And I'm glad you emphasized that. It is a dark chapter in American history. And unfortunately, our guest, George Takei, was impacted by that. We are visiting with a very special guest, actor and activist George Takei, one of the stars of the original Star Trek and then the movies as the character Sulu, the helmsman of the Starship Enterprise. He's in Pittsburgh this weekend with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, hosting a very special PNC pop show, the Sci-Fi Spectacular. The concert's opening on Friday and continuing on Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon as you get a chance to hear classical compositions that were a part of the soundtracks of classic sci-fi movies like 2001, A Space Odyssey, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and, of course, Star Trek. And the time is just flying by, George. It's been such a pleasurable visit, but there are some unpleasant things that I wanted to take the time to bring up that I know are important for you to talk about. We were talking about the show Allegiance, which is coming to Broadway, an award-winning musical about freedom, love, and loss in the Japanese-American internment camps on U.S. soil during World War II. You spent part of your childhood as one of the 120,000 Japanese-Americans placed in these internment camps. You were there between the ages of 4 and 8.
Actually, 5 and 9.
5 and 9, okay.
Yep.
5 and 9, those are very formative ages. What do you remember about that and how you dealt with it?
Well, I remember the barbed wire fence, obviously. That was the most prominent. That and the Sentry Tower were the most prominent. I also remember—
The Sentry Tower. So there's a guy up there with a gun who's going to shoot you if you try to get away.
Machine guns pointed at us, yes. But, you know, to a child, you adjust, and it became part of the landscape. I mean, it's grotesque. And abnormal, but it became part of my landscape. It became normal for me to line up 3 times a day to eat lousy food that everybody complained about in a noisy mess hall. It became routine for me to go with my father to bathe in a mass shower. At night, searchlights followed me when I made the night runs from our barrack to the latrine. But, you know, as a child, I thought it was kind of nice that they lit the way for me to pee, you know. So it was my child's perspective. I also remember, with irony now, we started the school day in a black tar paper barrack with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry tower right outside my schoolhouse window as I recited the words, "With liberty and justice for all." An innocent kid, just reciting words that the teacher taught us. But as a teenager, after the war, I couldn't reconcile what I knew to be my childhood with all the civics books that I was reading, with the shining ideals of our democracy. And, you know, I heard people like Dr. Martin Luther King, and he was inspiring. And, he talked about the ideals of democracy and the struggle for it. And so I engaged my father in long and sometimes heated discussions after dinner. And sometimes, I said things that I regret now to my father because he,
What did you say?
Well, one of the things I said that still haunts me is, "Daddy, you led us like sheep to slaughter when you took us into the internment camp." And I immediately sensed that I had struck a nerve because he became silent for what seemed like, a long, long time. And then he looked at me and said, "Well, maybe you're right." And he got up and he walked away and walked into the bedroom and closed the door. And I felt like, I've got to apologize. But he closed the door. And so I thought, well, tomorrow morning I'll apologize. And then it was awkward then, and I never did apologize. And that is one big regret I have in my life that, I need to atone for. But that man, my father, explained our democracy to me. He said, "Our democracy is a people's democracy, and it can be as great as a people can be, but it's also as fallible as people are. Our democracy is vitally dependent on good people who cherish those ideals of our democracy." And then he, one Sunday afternoon, he said, "Let me show you how democracy works." And he took me downtown to the headquarters of the Adlai Stevenson for President campaign. That's how I learned about our democracy.
We have just 30 seconds left. We had a tweet from David and Ben. They wanted to talk about the Howard Stern show came up earlier, and they wanted to talk about how social media is playing a role in your career now. You have an enormous number of Twitter followers, I think, or Facebook fans and Twitter followers. So you have to sum it up in 15 seconds, George. But
this morning,
yes,
I reached 8 million followers on Facebook, likes and shares. It's a benchmark achievement.
I think you're number one, aren't you?
I think it might be.
Well, number one in our hearts for sure.
George
Takei has been our guest. He's hosting the PNC Pop Sci-Fi Spectacular at Heinz Hall tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday. George Takei, thanks so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Great chatting with you. Thank you very much.
I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thank you for listening. Tomorrow, a special Life of Learning program. Until Monday, so long for now.